This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, June 23, 2004. I'm Nell Abram. Documents released yesterday in an attempt to distance President Bush from the prison torture scandal serve to raise even more questions. A mistrial is declared in the case of three men accused of murdering a California transgendered teen. And a new report on air pollution says the EPA vastly underestimates toxic emissions. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Bush administration has suffered a diplomatic defeat in its efforts to shield U.S. servicemen and others from the reach of the International Criminal Court. Susan Wood reports from the United Nations.
U.S. diplomats today abandoned a month-old effort to extend a U.N. Security Council resolution due to expire on June 30th. The measure would have given U.S. personnel serving in U.N.-authorized military operations another year's immunity from prosecution by the International Criminal Court. The U.S. exemption introduced in 2002 might have been extended indefinitely had it not been for U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan's opposition. Annan last week said that given the Iraq prisoner abuse, further U.S. immunity from the Global War Crimes Court would discredit the U.N. and the rule of law. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
Today, the Congressional Black Caucus called on the U.S. government to do more to stop the genocide in the Darfur region of Sudan. In D.C., Allison Kohler reports.
Reportedly, government-sponsored militias are continuing to burn down villages and kidnap, rape, and murder civilians in a genocidal campaign against African Muslims. Over 700,000 victims have fled to other regions of Sudan, while another 110,000 have escaped to the neighboring country of Chad. Sally Berger, the director of Africa Action, expresses his concerns.
10 years ago, the world stood by and watched while a genocide occurred in Rwanda. Now we have the opportunity to stop one as it's unfolding. And what remains is for the administration to say genocide, and then they're obliged to act.
Africa Action is currently petitioning for the U.S. Secretary of State, Colin Powell, to recognize the genocide in Darfur and to support immediate action. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., this is Allison Kohler.
10 Palestinian groups are objecting to the latest proposal that would place Egypt and Jordan security forces in Palestine. Leila Al-Haddad reports from Gaza.
In a joint statement issued by their offices in Damascus, the factions, including Hamas and the Popular and Democratic Fronts for the Liberation of Palestine, said the Egyptian rule will merely help advance the Israeli occupation by turning Gaza into a big prison. This is not an acceptable way to intervene and deal with the people who are defending their homeland, read the statement. The references to security turn things on their heads, making it seem as if the problem is the Palestinian people and not the occupation. Hamas, included as a main signatory to the statement, is considered to be the main competitor to Yasser Arafat's Fatah movement in a post-pullout scenario. Its popularity on the streets of Gaza stems from its extensive charitable works and its financial accountability. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leila Al-Haddad in the Gaza Strip.
Broad racial disparities in state and federal criminal justice systems are highlighted in a report by the American Bar Association Justice Kennedy Commission. Jenny Johnson has the story from D.C.
An African-American male born in 2004 has a 1 in 3 chance of being incarcerated sometime in his life if current trends continue. The report includes many recommendations, including the elimination of mandatory minimum sentencing. Instead, sentencing guidelines are preferred, along with providing alternatives to incarceration for drug abuse offenders and persons with mental illness. Stephen Salzberg, the commission's chair, said many are aware of the need for reform.
Basically, what we've discovered is there is enthusiasm across the board, judges, prosecutors, defense lawyers, and legislators, for being smarter when it comes to the criminal justice system. Because locking up people for long periods of time and then sending them back to the community without preparation means they're just going to commit more crimes. They're going to be more victims, and they're going to return to prison.
Jenny Johnson, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
The Greens opened their convention today in Milwaukee to decide who will be the party's nominee for president. From the Workers' Independent News Service, Sarah Turner reports.
It may not be Ralph Nader who wins the Green Party's endorsement this year. Several people are vying for the nomination, but besides Nader, only longtime party activist David Cobb has a chance. He served as the general counsel for the Green Party of the United States until declaring his candidacy, and was the Green Party of Texas candidate for attorney general in 2002. To bolster his chances, Ralph Nader chose another longtime Green Party activist, Peter Camejo, as his running mate. Party members vote for a nominee on Saturday. Also on the convention agenda is a Sunday anti-war pro-jobs march and adopting an official party platform. With the Workers' Independent News Service for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Sarah Turner in Wisconsin.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Last night, the Pentagon and the White House revealed several hundred pages of internal documents concerning interrogation procedures of detainees. The White House claims the documents prove that President Bush never approved torture. However, critics say the unveiled documents raise more questions than they answer. Mitch Jezerich is on Capitol Hill.
A memo dated February 7, 2002, signed by President Bush, indicates that the administration accepted the Justice Department's recommendation that the Geneva Accords did not apply to both al-Qaeda fighters and Taliban fighters in Afghanistan. The memo said that only the parties who signed onto the treaty are eligible for such protections, and that the Taliban fighters were ineligible because it was a so-called failed state. Other such Geneva Accord requirements, the administration argues, is that fighters must wear a visible uniform. Earlier this month, Attorney General John Ashcroft further explained at a congressional hearing.
According to the convention itself, those nations that are high contracting parties to the convention, al-Qaeda is not a high contracting party to the Geneva Convention. It repudiates the rules of war. It operates against civilians. It doesn't wear uniforms. And it has never sought to be a high contracting party. The Geneva Conventions do not apply.
Yes, they apply. You know, these protections are always in place, and they apply by virtue of the fact that an armed conflict has taken place.
Bianca Colucci is an international justice specialist for Amnesty International.
Now, the question is, should detainees be afforded prisoner of war status? And when it comes to that question, that's not for the president or the secretary of defense or the president's lawyers to decide on their own. The Geneva Conventions are clear about the fact that if there is a question, that should be decided by what's described as a competent tribunal in the Geneva Conventions.
In the same February 2002 memo, President Bush did order that detainees be treated humanely in a manner consistent with the principles of the Geneva Accords. Tuesday night, the administration released a number of internal memos to try to show that President Bush did not call for torture.
This is like Richard Nixon when he was being investigated in Watergate. They kept on sending out little bits and pieces of information to the Congress. Well, finally, Congress said, no, that's not enough. We want it all. We want to know the facts. And the Supreme Court of the United States had to force him to turn over the tapes.
House Democratic Representative Henry Waxman is co-sponsoring a resolution calling on the administration to hand over more documents. The other co-sponsor of the resolution, Representative John Conyers, who is the ranking Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, says he has previously requested several more documents that weren't included in the batch released on Tuesday.
Basically, these documents are not adequate, and there are not reports from the Red Cross and other human rights groups, which are crucial. There's no information about keeping detainees off prison rosters, as the Secretary of Defense himself has admitted that he did.
However, getting such a resolution through a GOP-controlled House is questionable. Republican Representative Phil Gingrich represents Georgia.
We're dangerously over-focusing on the prisoner abuse issue. I think members of Congress, indeed, and certainly the media is myopic. On this issue. Keep in mind that we did have the quote moral authority unquote when the four security contractors were ambushed, burned, their bodies dragged through the streets of Fallujah, and the carcasses then hung from telephone poles for public display.
Another released document dated December of 2002 indicates Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld approved such interrogative techniques as stripping prisoners to humiliate them, using dogs to threaten them, and using stress positions such as having detainees stand for 4 straight hours. Then in March of 2003, a group of legal advisors told Rumsfeld that some of those methods may be perceived as war violations. Rumsfeld then ordered some of the techniques to be curtailed. All interrogative methods used by the U.S. are still unknown. Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News.
A report released yesterday by the D.C.-based Environmental Integrity Project and the Galveston-Houston Association for Smog Prevention reveals the nation's database for toxic pollution is severely underestimating emissions from chemical plants and refineries across the country. From KPFT in Houston, Erica McDonald tells us that actual emissions were found to be 4 or 5 times higher than the EPA's Toxic Release Inventory, or TRI, listings.
You see some big movement among the states in terms of their total air pollution. Texas went up by 159.6 million pounds, and that's up 155%. New Mexico went up 1 million pounds. Louisiana went up 56 million.
TRI is the national collection system for air pollution data that many states and municipalities use to develop clean air plans. The public also relies on these listings for information about what chemicals they are breathing. The problem is, the EPA gets its data from the industry itself. While many state agency, federal government, and nonprofit studies have revealed the industry was fudging its numbers to the EPA, the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality conducted the first study which quantifies just how much companies were underreporting. A new report, Who's Counting?, applies the Texas findings nationwide to find it's likely that the EPA missed more than 330 million pounds of pollution. The Environmental Integrity Project's Kelly Harrigan says the EPA knows the factors they use to calculate emissions data are flawed and have failed to take action to correct the problem.
And EPA acknowledges that a lot of those factors are just plain bad. They've graded their own emission factors, and more than half of them are rated below average. It's not a priority for EPA. They don't really want the emissions to look higher. They keep coming out with numbers, you know, claiming that emissions are going down. And without accurate reporting, we don't really know what emissions are doing. So they just don't seem to have much interest in making sure that we really have accurate numbers.
In fact, the EPA did establish a working group to develop better emissions factors, but the effort was halted when EPA funding was slashed. But Galveston-Houston Association for Smog Prevention's John Wilson says accurate data is critical to states working to bring smoggy cities into compliance with the Federal Clean Air Act.
We're tired of accounting tricks that industry uses to show that its pollution releases are dropping when we know that the amount of pollution we're measuring in the air is going up. We really want EPA to require these companies to take real measurements so that their pollution data are accurate and useful.
FSRN's calls to the EPA were not returned by airtime. Environmental groups want the EPA to put monitors at the plants and refineries to track what's really going into the air. 4 of the 10 chemicals studied in the report are airborne carcinogens. Actual emissions of benzene, propylene, ethylene, and butadiene may be more than 400% higher than the EPA reports. Ann Rolfes of the Louisiana Bucket Brigade said underreporting of toxic emissions is about much more than just numbers.
This isn't just some dry report, numbers and graphs on a page. This is about real people with real illnesses. In Chalmette, Louisiana, for example, next to the ExxonMobil oil refinery, in one block with 12 houses, you have 10 of those houses that have suffered from cancer. Kids, they play outside in their clothes, they'll soon be covered with petroleum coke dust. They sometimes end up with this coke dust in their mouths. These are not numbers. These are people who have lives and for whom this pollution has real ramifications.
The groups demand the EPA use accurate numbers for TRI, a program the agency began 20 years ago to ease the public's fears after the Union Carbide disaster in Bhopal, India.
Our experience, our sad experience, and in Louisiana, it's true that people are suffering ongoing, slow, catastrophic Bhopals every day of our lives.
From KPFT in Houston, I'm Erica McDonald for Free Speech Radio News.
The nuclear crisis that began in October of 2002 when North Korea quit the Non-Proliferation Treaty and expelled international inspectors has yet to find a solution. Six-party talks, initiated by the Chinese government and involving North Korea, South Korea, Japan, and Russia, opened their third session in Beijing today. Severine Bardon reports.
The last sessions of non-proliferation discussions closed on a dead end. Washington insisted on the complete, verifiable, and irreversible dismantlement of North Korea's weapons programs, both plutonium and uranium, before any negotiations. At the same time, Pyongyang didn't recognize the existence of a uranium project and only wanted to discuss a freeze of its plutonium program under the condition of economic assistance and security guarantees. Delegates arriving in Beijing haven't been optimistic about the possible outcome of a new round of discussions. But after 2 days of working groups, both the United States and North Korea seem eager to improve their relations. Lee Dun-jo is the General Secretary of the Research Center on North Korean History within the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. He explains how important today's opening speeches are.
Delegates from all the countries, and especially from the United States and North Korea, have shown new characteristics and changes in their opening speeches. North Korean delegate Kim Kai-gwan expressed his will to see this round of negotiations move beyond the theoretical level and see it reach concrete results, concrete improvements. American proposals are not as obvious as the North Korean ones are. James Kelly also expressed his will to reach real improvements, but at the same time he went on emphasizing the necessity of a complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula.
James Kelly said he was prepared for serious discussion and had a proposal to offer, even though he did not provide any detail. But North Korea and the United States still haven't solved the question of the uranium program. The United States didn't provide any proof of the existence of this project, and even China expressed its doubts about it. Chang Fengjun, a teacher and researcher specializing in Eastern Asia at Beijing University, says this question will be the main focus of the coming negotiations.
Most important will probably be to find out whether North Korea really has this uranium program. Last time, the question wasn't raised. Or maybe it was just at the very beginning of talks. But this time, this issue will be examined thoroughly and in a more concrete way. We first need to gather the opinions of the North Korean delegates, and only then will China be able to form its own opinion.
Another cause of concern for the delegates of these six-party talks is the upcoming U.S. presidential elections. Again, Chang Fengjun.
Actually, the six-party talks are closely linked to the American elections. The Bush administration won't make any decision this time. It might make some adjustments, but only minor ones, that's all. I think that's one of the main reasons why we can't expect any breakthrough in the talks this time.
All the countries involved in the talks, except the U.S., have thus started to build up their own policy towards North Korea. China has received Kim Jong-il in April with all the honors due to the head of state. South Korea has initiated some military links with the North in the demarcation zone, something unheard of for the past 50 years. Even Japan, which used to defend the American demands, restarted talks on establishing formal diplomatic ties with Pyongyang. And it also rewarded the release of the relatives of Japanese citizens kidnapped by northern spies by promising food, medicines, and medical supplies worth an estimated $10 million. North Korea is developing a strategy with its neighboring countries to obtain more international support. The aim is to isolate the United States in its tough demands, Lee Dun-jo explains.
It eventually won't be in the interest of the U.S. to maintain its position. If North Korea makes concessions and the U.S. doesn't react positively, then the Americans won't have the understanding or the support of most of the countries and of the international community.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Severine Bardon in Beijing.
The murder trial of three 24-year-old California men accused of killing transgendered teenager Gwen Araujo ended in a mistrial after the judge described the jury as hopelessly deadlocked. Gay and transgendered activists across the nation followed the case, which was prosecuted as a hate crime. Prosecutors say two of the defendants had sex with Araujo and plotted to murder the teen after they learned that he was biologically male. The defendants, Jason Cesares, Michael Magidson, and Jose Morel, were facing 25 years to life if convicted. Brian Garcia has more.
Alameda County Deputy District Attorney Chris Lamero, who prosecuted the case, explains what the jury was asked to consider when deciding if the killing of Gwen Araujo was to be murder or the lesser charge of manslaughter.
In order to have a murder reduced to a manslaughter based on a heat of passion, it's not enough that the killer himself act in a subjective heat of passion. It's necessary that the jury come to the conclusion that you would expect that the ordinarily reasonable person of average disposition would also react from passion, from rage, rather than from thought and from judgment.
According to Michael Thorman, attorney for Michael Magenson, the shock and embarrassment that his client suffered upon finding out that Araujo was biologically a man was sufficient to meet the requirements of a heat of passions killing, thus constituting manslaughter, not murder. Thorman argues that a reasonable person under similar circumstances would have responded the same way.
For a heterosexual young male to believe that he had sex with a female only to discover that he'd been deceived and that the person that he had sex with was a male is the kind of thing that caused and would cause a reasonable person under the same circumstances to have an emotional reaction rather than reacting from judgment. But under the law, it's a manslaughter, not a murder.
The jury did not agree. Chris Daly is co-director of the Transgender Law Center.
According to the district attorney's office, not a single juror believed the horrific messages that the defense attorneys were trying to put out in blaming Gwen for her own murder. All of them decided that a manslaughter conviction would not be appropriate for any of the three defendants. In doing so, they rejected the idea that Gwen had deceived these guys, that she had stolen their heterosexuality, and all the other just gross and negative strategies that the defense team tried to use to play on societal bias against transgender people.
Daly, who sat through several days of the proceedings, was frustrated the case ended in a mistrial, but believes that justice is simply delayed for Gwen Araujo, but will not be denied. Again, Chris Daly.
I felt that there was more than adequate evidence to find all three of these men guilty of first-degree murder. However, I mean, I am realistic in understanding that, you know, justice takes time sometimes. And considering the experiences that too many transgender people have had in our court system, this is definitely a win.
Julie Dorf, director of philanthropic services with the Horizon Foundation, agrees. Dorf believes that even though justice was not handed down, the mistrial is progress for transgender people in this country.
It is a step forward. This jury did say, and our society, therefore, as you know, represented by these 12 people, said, you know, that this person, this transgender teen's life, even though we don't completely understand it, was valued just as much as any other human being.
The case is far from over. All three defendants have been recharged with the murder of Gwen Araujo, will remain in custody, and a new trial will begin in a matter of months. Defense attorney Michael Thorman believes that getting any jury to hand down the unanimous verdict necessary to convict the defendants will be difficult even when the case is retried.
The question that I have in my mind is whether there's ever going to be a unanimous verdict in this case. Unlike almost any other case I can think of, I think that people, because of life experience, values, philosophy, come to this case with a particular take on it, and any 12 reasonable people are likely to disagree.
This is Brian Garcia, reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
The world is coming to terms with new diseases like SARS, but very few know that there are more alarming and fatal diseases facing the world's indigenous populations. Some say more alarming even than AIDS, since it is genetically inherited, is sickle cell anemia. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Binu Alex visits central and western Indian regions where the indigenous people of India are affected.
Both of us are having severe headaches. It just doesn't get cured, although we take medicines.
That was Sancharben from the western Indian state of Gujarat. She has been diagnosed with the disease sickle cell. 28% of India's 80 million indigenous population are carriers of a disease called sickle cell anemia, and 3% of them are facing death. 5-year-old Kokila is Sanchar's daughter. Sickle cell anemia is caused by a defect in the blood component hemoglobin, which can be extremely painful and raise the risk of pneumonia and strokes. But for the indigenous people of India that fall victim to the illness, this is a natural death. Sickle cell anemia was first observed by a German doctor in the 40s as a collapse of red blood cells, which loses its original shape and sickles, thus causing the ability to retain oxygen to diminish dramatically and the possibilities of exhaustion, collapse, and even death. One of the most known tribal activists, Dr. Ganesh Devi, is of the opinion that sickle cell in India is as alarming as AIDS, but very little funding or research is done into it because it's not as attractive as AIDS and money is difficult to come by.
We need to teach them how to cope with their limited life in a manner that their families are not left with many orphans. Unfortunately, the medical fraternity in this country, or perhaps in most developing countries, is indifferent to the diseases of the poor. In this case, what we need to cure is the attitude to poverty.
Due to low literacy rates in the area, those working in the field are unable to explain the condition. With very little development in these areas, even reaching a hospital is a difficult task. Rajan Travaria is one of the activists in Chota Udaipur in central India.
Since the tribal people are illiterate, we are not able to give proper information about sickle cell. What they understand is if they fall ill or feel feverish, it could be fatal.
These indigenous people who work as daily wage laborers can't afford treatment on a day-to-day basis. Very few government hospitals that exist in these areas have facilities to tackle this disease. Earning less than $1 per day for an entire family is barely enough to survive, let alone paying for a private hospital. Realizing this, Dr. Devi has set up a team in his tribal academy to provide free treatment and to study the mapping of genes with whatever limitations these small villages have.
The research in sickle cell all over the world has received dismally low funding support. Sickle cell is a poor man's disease, and therefore the politics of research funding is causing the death of so many sickle cell patients. In the records of the WHO, if you find the term sickle cell even in lower case, I am prepared to give ₹1 million.
In the US, more than 70,000 people have sickle cell anemia, with the majority found in African Americans. In the past, most patients diagnosed with the disease died during childhood. But now, the average lifespan has climbed to the mid-40s. Many African countries, the Middle East, and indigenous areas of India also have high sickle cell rate. But for India, little funding for research and education about the disease has been the case due to these deaths being labeled as natural causes. Although the Indian government has showed little interest, the community leaders say they will exert more pressure on the government for counseling and research to gain control over disease. From Chota Udaipur in central India, Pinu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York, KPFA in Berkeley, and KPFK in Los Angeles, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. To find out more or for archives of the newscast, go to www.fsrn.org. I'm Nell Abram.